and Secretary, Department of Defense Research and Development, Ministry of Defense, since 1982. Having got his PhD from Wales, he has worked in various departments in this country, including the National Aeronautical Laboratory. Some of you visited the laboratory in the morning, I hear. And he was there from 75 to 82. He has been associated with various research organizations working on metallurgy. He is the recipient of many distinguished awards, including the S.S. Bhatnagar Award and the Padma Bhushan from the President of India. Dr. Arunachalam will speak on future of India's defense.
The wily French politician Clemenceau, immediately after the First World War, declared that war is too important a matter to be left to the generals. Today, if a general has to comment on war, he would say that war, or for that matter today, he would call it defense, because most of the departments of war have become departments of defense today. It is too important a matter to be left to politicians and bureaucrats. Then who ought to be minding war or defense of a country or a society? Then of course calls for a definition of what is a defense here. Are we going to talk about defense in the conventional sense of the term, that means the military defense? Are we going to talk about defense of a society from a cultural aggression or economic aggression, or defense of against a disease? Everyone is a conservation theorem of a society wanting to protect itself. But in this afternoon's talk, I would like to concentrate on only defense in the conventional sense of the term. Defense, as we know today, as a military defense. Part of our military defense is not in our hands at all. We are the prisoners of our geography. And we are also the prisoners of our history. Geography, one, you cannot get away from that at all. You cannot choose your neighbors any more than you can choose your parents. You are born with such neighbors, except that you can hope, as it happened in some West European nations, that the neighbors, the hostile neighbors, have been decimated away. It took time and it took an effort, but that was also a possibility. That means that we can free ourselves from being mere prisoners of history. If we are careful and look after our defense carefully, we can even rewrite history. Talking about history, we are always ending up in the contradiction. It was Santana who said that persons who forget their past are condemned to relive it. But we also know that if we are continuously obsessed with history, we are living in our past and refusing to look into new opportunities, new events that may be overtaking the entire world, and more than anything else, provide new initiatives. So defense is caught between the two, even in a military system. And what are the imperatives and the determinants of a defense of a country, especially as ours? I would like to show what exactly are our major concerns. Our first concern is, of course, the threat from neighbors. They are important. In a sense, they determine that how much money we spend on defense and where we ought to put the priorities. And the second, of course, is that we have to worry about saying how is our relationship with other major countries. Countries like European Community or United States or the independent Soviet states. We ought to look in our planning of defense, not just what's happened yesterday in Kashmir or what may happen tomorrow in Chinese border. We ought to have our long-term interests. The long-term interests are the ones that are going to determine that what ought to be our posture. Where do we want India to be? 10 years later, 50 years later, 100 years later? What ought to be our concerns? Not only the temporary concerns that we may have with the neighbors of today, and also what ought to be the relationship with the kind of countries like Soviet Union or United States. This is also important, as you would have read in newspapers just a few days back,
Now the Americans are retargeting their nuclear weapons, targeting towards the third world. Who are the people to whom we ought to worry? But the major concern for us is the indigenous capability. We have no right to talk about a defense with any amount of confidence unless we can talk about some amount of capability. Capability that is homegrown, available in times of emergency, and not dependent on others. We take this indigenous capability for granted. We assume that the capability exists or does not exist and start worrying about what is going to happen here or what is going to happen there. I don't like quoting Gaddafi, but I think even he can be quoted occasionally. And one instance was about the non-aligned meet in Harare just about 2 years back. If you remember the newspaper reports at the time, Gaddafi didn't come on the first day. The second day he came, I think his visit was a very interesting one because he came with 20 extraordinarily good-looking female bodyguards. He came there, gave a speech and walked away. In the speech he said, "What is this buffoonery of non-aligned nations? None of you is non-aligned," he said, "except China and India. These two countries are non-aligned and they can be free because they have options of all technologies. All of you, you just come here to say, drink, eat and have a good time." And he walked away. You may not agree with Gaddafi, but Gaddafi had a point, because when chips are down and when we talk about relationship, not just with our neighbors, relationship with superpowers, which can also become super bullies, the indigenous capability is very important. The next point, of course, is the fact that can we afford defense? This is becoming increasingly relevant in times of economic crisis, because everybody is saying, no, defense is too costly, too expensive, you cannot afford it. But look at the way Japan or just Germany have made it. They could make it because of the fact they spent very little on defense. But some other rich uncle was looking after them. So can we afford this defense at all? This is a thing that couples naturally with the political policy and even to an extent the national ethos. Do we want again to be dependent on another foreign power? Or you think that we ought to spend money on defense in spite of the fact the schools get robbed, the hospitals are ill-equipped and the trains don't have enough engines? We still say that if we think it's important for us to remain free in the terms that we feel that we must have an indigenous capability, we must have an indigenous defense, and we should be able to afford them. These, I think, are the major factors that govern us. In fact, when we make policies on defense, I don't think we worry about these things. Later, having made policies, you start worrying whether these things fit into the pattern at all. Because in our obsession with our neighbors, we continue to think of the short-term ones like Pakistan. What's going to happen with Pakistan? Every hiccup by a Pakistan foreign secretary about nuclear weapon, or every statement alleged to have been made, one Pakistan official or another official makes headlines here, because we feel that we are still living day to day in our defense preparedness. We still, I fear, have no long-term interests. We still, I fear, have no such plan of saying, where do we want our country to be in the next century? The aggression can be very, very subtle, and also it can be covert, and it can be also brute and blatant. Initially, our country was continuously invaded by people who came and stayed in the country and occasionally building empires. Except for Alexander, who returned, rest of the Muslim invaders who came from the north found India a very rich country with opportunities, though Babur went on worrying of missing the muskmelon and the snows of Afghanistan. Most of the others stayed put. They found the country to be rich and they wanted to build empires. Akbar or Shah Jahan or Aurangzeb were as much a product of India as any other person. And the next came was the colonialism. Colonialism came as traders wanting all kinds of concessions, wanting to see that the trade is not threatened, more opportunities were opened up for trade, And out of that came the open military action. If 1857 is one such example in the history of our country, you can look into China, where you found even the insistence on trading on opium could lead to a war. But this was followed up in after the Second World War by the world breaking up into two major pact countries, Warsaw Pact and NATO. And there they said is mutually assured destruction brought in a kind of strategic deterrence, a deterrence which was not peace, which was not stable peace, neither was it war, and we were living in a period of no war and no peace situation, waiting the other guy would buckle. It just so happened that the days of Cold War are over, and Soviet Union, as we knew then, has lost the war. And as Witt put it, Japan and Germany are the winners. And if you look into this, we are also seeing a new trend emerging. The new trend is coming through terrorist activities. If there was a period when we found that the terrorist activities would decrease, there was also a period, you remember the 1950s and 60s, one did not hear of Ireland as we hear of Ireland today. One did not hear of even Cyprus at the time as we heard Cyprus in 1970s. And we talk of our own borders. We talk about the small segment of Armenian population in Azerbaijan. And we talk about a variety of small countries, small cultures, talking about saying, adopting terrorist activities to prove a point. The case, of course, is the Palestinians were cited as an example. But then, of course, Palestinians cite even Israel as a kind of a nation that was going through these covert operations. And this is becoming an important concern today, because except if you ignore Australia and the United States, you find most of the countries are now subject to some kind of terrorism. Terrorism as in the case of Peru, where you found that a group of people, Shining Path people, just, I think they are the worst form of Naxalites, willing to kill themselves in the process. Perhaps the only nearest comparison we can talk about terrorists will be the LTTE. And the last one is the one that our first Prime Minister was worried constantly. We were worried because we felt that through the trade, the occupation starts with the trade, colonialism starts with the trade, and we were terribly, terribly concerned what trades would bring. It was this that made us choose much more of public sector. A tremendous suspicion towards our own traders in the beginning years of our independence was because of this fear of economic aggression. Because we felt trade would allow colonialization. What are the political scenes today? When we talk about defense, we only have to look into the map of our country, and little later we will have the quantitative numbers coming in. We ask ourselves, what is our current level of strength with respect to Pakistan and China? I don't want to give the quantitative numbers of how many squadrons Pakistan has got, how many squadrons India has, how many divisions China has in its border with in the northeast border of our country, and so on. These are details you can very easily fill up, though I think I will come to some numbers little later. We ought to ask ourselves, saying, what is our relationship today with Pakistan, not only militarily, in every sphere, if we have any other sphere with respect to Pakistan at all, and also in China. This is important in planning for our short-term defense, and definitely important in our long-term defense. You might remember, just about a few years back, there was a major hiccup, because one Chinese foreign minister said, better policing of the India-China border. He didn't even call it a border, he said India-China disputed territory. That sent all kinds of alarm bells ringing in the South Bloc. And then later, we said that we would also start policing our territory much more carefully, and with an airlifting of a large number of divisions. Then came the Chinese agreement, saying, again, spoken in that kind of a flowery language, peace and tranquility in the border. So that's where it is today. When we talk about the China and the India border, we are talking about peace and tranquility. How long the peace? What kind of a tranquil one we are talking about? Especially at a time when we are finding that the northern Tibet and also areas Xinjiang and especially regions around Xi'an are now continuously shocked by Islamic fundamentalists. There are reports of police shooting. There are reports of military occupying Xi'an and declaring martial law. And you also know of the amount of riots that are taking place in Lhasa, in Tibet. And we are also talking about the tremendous human rights violations the other countries mentioned about what was happening in Tibet. This is important to us while looking into the divisions of military across the border. And China today may have 6 divisions across the border against us. Maybe at a pinch may be able to draw, let us say, 9 divisions. All these numbers will have no meaning if the teeth to tail ratio is badly affected by their insecurity in Tibet itself. And you would also realize that most of these things, to a large extent, as we see our border with respect to Pakistan in Punjab and Kashmir, are a matter of great concern to us, because terrorist activity in Punjab or Kashmir makes our job much more difficult should there be a war with Pakistan. It's not different in the case of China. Luckily for us, our side of the border with respect to China, whether it is Arunachal Pradesh or Sikkim or Ladakh or even Uttar Pradesh, we do not have that kind of an unsettled conditions as the Chinese are facing in Tibet. We cannot underestimate the difficulties they are having today, because the only one road, very fragile road, links Chinese mainland with Tibet, and that road, the Chinese claim, is often attacked by bandits, and the Tibetans call it independent fighters. And there are also the relationship with other countries start becoming important to us. You notice that the amount of discussions that appear in newspapers today of the American concern of us having not signed the non-proliferation treaty. The Americans talk about all the time that the nuclear war could take place much more easily in the Indian subcontinent than elsewhere. In spite of the fact that we were all the time saying that the vertical proliferation of nuclear weapon is more dangerous, because a large number of nuclear weapons accumulated and stored by one power is more dangerous than a large number of countries having some small number, we find today we were proved true, because the fissioning out of Soviet Union has thrown in not one or two weapons, even in tactical nuclear weapons, we are talking about 15,000 nuclear weapons of ammunition, 152 millimeter, just ammunition. You are talking about the Tochka, the short-range missile, Scud, the world missile, small landmines, small naval mines, all these things, and even surface-to-air missile, if they had nuclear weapons. All these things have come into play. And today, the United States, the report again talks about saying United States, Britain and France are realigning their nuclear threats, and many of the targets may ultimately end up to be Hyderabad, Bengaluru or something else. And the same thing is happening in not only in NPT, it is also happening in the missiles technology control regime. If you want to get any technology on missiles now today, we will not be able to get it. This technology list is ludicrous, because it encompasses very strategic systems like the inertial navigation system, laser guidance system, some of the solid propellant. It also, if you want to buy a magnesium alloy today, you cannot do that, because they say that you are using it for military purposes. How are we going to react? How does the world look into a country becoming independent in these technologies? You might remember that in one of the outcomes of the Iraqi war was systematic destruction of every nuclear technological laboratory, foundry or factories in Iraq. They were annoyed because the Allied powers could not locate some of the factories, so they continue, even when they had doubts, the job was to destroy the factory. You saw the Libyan one, when they have a suspicion that a particular satellite photograph suggests the setting up of a chemical weapons plant, the United States said that it would not do, and they have taken steps to see that some of these possible weapon sites are destroyed. What if these countries can do to Iraq and Libya today? Will they be doing it to us? Is it possible that both the Atlantic Alliance as well as the European community say that India is not entitled to have her Agnis or Prithvis or something, and India either must abandon them, otherwise we will make India abandon. This is not a far-fetched fear. After all, don't forget that the Iraqis and the Israelites could go there and bomb the Iraqi nuclear reactor facility under construction. And they now today claim, saying, having done that, we saved the Allied troops from a possible nuclear attack. And this may happen, saying that, look, we have got to look into this. And all these things we have to take into account when we are planning our defense of a country today, not necessarily for tomorrow or a few years later. The economic scenes are really very grim. I do not have to go into the details except to say that the defense budget is today very small. We are talking about the defense budget in 91-92 is about 16,500 crores, and this is less than 4% of GNP. And you have noticed that whether it is in the Indian case, GNP or GDP does not matter, they are almost synonymous. And we find that this is continuing to be small. And when we talk about increasing the GDP, increasing the percentage of GDP, out comes the answer saying, why don't we increase the GDP for the same percentage, your defense budget can be large. The trade deficit has gone so high that many of the imports of the defense systems have stopped. In fact, we have not been able to pay for some of the things we have imported, like the Bofors gun or the Harrier aircraft for the Navy or the Mirage 2000 for the Air Force. And we find that the terms of payment are such that we have to say that can we pay that few years later because of our the troubles of trade deficit, and also there is a free foreign exchange is missing. There is a lot we have to say about the difficulty we have with the Soviet Union. The Soviet, when our history gets written, I do not know what they will have to say, what it will have to say about Soviet collaboration in defense. Was it a blessing? Was it a curse? Did it help our country take off, or did it push our country into a great deal of difficulties? Today it's too early for us to say. You remember when we embraced the Soviet Union in 1950s, late 50s and early 60s for our weapon systems, systematically we have destroyed our indigenous capability being built up to go on by. No other country barring the erstwhile Soviet Union had the aircrafts they as we had today, MiG-21, 23, 27, 25, 29. I mean, if the Soviet Union made an aircraft, we are the buyer. We went to that extent that it ended up in the Navy. If you look into most of the naval ships, except for the Leander class frigates, most of them were of Soviet origin. To the credit of Navy, they not only got the ships, they also got the designs to manufacture in the country. But still the percentage of foreign dependence was very large. Army was the last to get in, but Army is such a major force in our defense that even a small amount of the dependence is very large indeed. And if we have today the current NCR troubles, we do not know where the spare parts are coming from. And it was not easy to make a spare part. If you said that, okay, I would make spare parts for T-72, and if it would cost you 10,000 rupees, the Soviets were selling it for 5,000 rupees. They gave you a holiday for repayment for 10 years, and then later they charged you an interest of 2-3%. No Indian company could afford to charge that. No Indian company could afford to go for a tax holiday, a repayment holiday. It was an attempt. I do not know whether the Soviets deliberately did that. But we like children to going to the supermarket with toy shop and writing with the credit card all the things they could buy. We just went on buying. We did not even ask ourselves saying that can we afford to pay back all those things? Can we have the maintenance support? We assume because of our 1971 experience of signing a very quickly a kind of pact with Indo-Soviet agreement, we thought that whenever there is a trouble, our big brother in Moscow was there ready and available. How are we going to help this? So when we look into the economic scene, more than the political scene, the thing that looms very large in the horizon is how are we going to handle the dissolution of Soviet Union? We then have to look into what are the areas that we have to defend. The Indian area is very large. Again, you will see that little later. Do we worry about Indonesia occupying a Great Nicobar now and then put all our forces in Nicobar, saying that we shall not allow 1 inch of, let us say, Indira Gandhi Point to be occupied by Indonesians? Or do we say that the Burmese, Myanmar are getting troublesome? They are a noisy lot. They could suddenly go and occupy part of Manipur. What are we going to do? And we concentrate on this. So we have got to make ourselves clear what are the areas we have to defend. And this, even when we take what are the areas we have to defend, we are running into difficulties, because at the worst of the times, we find we have to fight one and a half war. One war against Pakistan. China is not going to remain exactly friendly. Even a gentle noise by China would be misconstrued by our country. And so we have to, if anything, given a chance, our generals would say, look, we have to have a two front, then we must have the capability. Fighting a war against China and fighting a war against Pakistan at the same time. And this is something that we have got to worry about. And then we also ought to make it a realistic statement, saying that, look, I think we are going to have peace and tranquility for the time being. And then we say that we will only cover ourselves with Pakistan, and also in territories that matter immediately to us, and not necessarily every bit of these things. And this, unfortunately, this is now added with the problem of internal troubles. We talked about our elections in Punjab. I don't know how the elections are going to be. We do not know how the military trains will be able to reach Punjab in numbers, in times of war, when all the other people would be involved in activities connected with the war. Can we protect our front? And can we protect our back? And in the case of Kashmir, you might remember that that beautiful book on the 1947-48 Kashmir war, Slender Was the Thread, how we managed to free Kashmir. We managed to free Kashmir at that time because the whole population was with us. They were against the intruders. Can we manage to save Kashmir from Pakistan today? How much of the war we have to fight within Kashmir and in the border? The status of internal troubles can also go extreme, because at one stage, you might remember last year and a year before, that the Nepalese problems became important to us. Suddenly we found Nepal was buying anti-aircraft guns from China. Nepal did not have to have worry about anti-aircraft guns. When we asked for them, they said, why not? It's a good buy. And if today we talk about Nepal and tomorrow it may be Bhutan, we still do not know that what is the relationship of Bhutan with China. The king, when you talk to the king of Bhutan, he talks in monosyllables, saying that he is for peace and he is for friendship. Friendship with respect to what? And we find that the current state of internal troubles, at no time has our republic faced so much of border problems, so much of problems in states adjoining our border as we are facing today. The only consolation being, we have not had a rebellion in the Kar Nicobar. And when we talk about the border intrusions are coming more and more. On an average, if you go through the statistics, there will be at least 900 small arms or big arms fired a day. No day passes without fire, without about 900 accidents or incidents. And these border intrusions are becoming so effective that you start putting all kinds of fences in Punjab, they come through Rajasthan. You start looking in Rajasthan, they come near Jammu. You start looking into the Jammu, you saw that report of about 50 Pakistani-trained Kashmiri boys having frostbite and totally exposed in cold, because they decided to cross the front in here, not too far from Srinagar, which is a very difficult place to cross. And just about a week back, thanks to one of our radars, the border security force detected a large number of camels. The camels were not empty. They were loaded with guns and intruders coming on camels as though they were traders. If you talk about the border intrusion, thanks to the increase in civil traffic, thanks to the long border that we have today, that the border intrusions are increasing and not decreasing. The only consolation being that the critical place in Punjab the border intrusions are decreasing today because of better border management and fencing. The borders are not small. And you, when we talk about the 3,310 kilometers of border with Pakistan, we also have 300 kilometers there and about 665 kilometers of line of actual control. Rest of them is an international border. You talk about the Indo-Bangladesh border, you talk about the Indo-China border, they are all very, very long borders. The Chinese border starts somewhere in Himachal Pradesh. Why Himachal Pradesh? It starts in Kashmir and then goes into Himachal Pradesh, Uttar Pradesh, and you name the states and they go on having all the northeastern states. If you are talking about the border, it is really a very, very long border. And unless we have some guarantee of peace in some regions, unless we can come to some agreement, or unless we enunciate a policy, like you remember the famous statement by Gorbachev, he said that Soviet territory is a sacred territory, if somebody intrudes, we will shoot them. The equivalent saying that if anybody ventures into even occupation of a few kilometers, can we drive them out? We also learned the lesson of 1962 when Pandit Nehru said, drive out the Chinese and look what happened. So if we have to call it a bluff, then we have to call the bluff, then we ought to have the wherewithal to see that we are able to protect our border. Can you understand? And we talk also of the military expenditure. After all, we ought to look into with respect to Pakistan, with respect to India, and you would see that in constant United States dollars, so you could see that where we are with respect to Pakistan, where we are with respect to China, and where we are with respect to India. One important factor there you have to bear in mind is the fact that the Chinese budget is a fudged one, because all the military production in China is going into the civil sector. It is not, for instance, research and development in China is approximately one-third of this budget. We are talking about $7 billion. But you would not see the $7 billion here, because the $7 billion is put in the country's civil research and development budget. And we also ought to look into the GNP1. And you find that Indian GNP is about 3.5 and China is about 3.9 and Pakistan is 6.9. But if you look into any neighboring country of ours, you would find that no country has a lower GNP than us. If you want to look into the nearest one of the lower GNP, perhaps you have to go to Australia, which has about 2.5%. They don't have any threats except from kangaroos. And if you look into the, what is the military we have per 1,000 citizens? If you look into India, we have about 1.7. China is 3.5. And this 3.5 is after they have demobilized about 1 million soldiers. In China, you really don't know who constitutes the Red Army, because there is a police, there is a security guard, there is a border guard, and so on. But even we take only the military one today, that we are talking about 3.5 per thousand population. In Pakistan, it's about 4.5. And even you can equal well calculate about the defense expenditure with respect to citizen, or the number of soldiers with respect to 1 kilometer of border protection, you would notice that we have nothing compared either to Pakistan or to China. If this statistics appears very grim to you, the only consolation I can tell you is averages can be extraordinarily misleading. Because you can have a tremendous amount of border protection in some regions, and there may be regions you will have one man and a dog. So this gives you an idea that when people talk about the control of defense expenditure, when they talk about saying that we are spending too much in defense, our defense is determined by our neighbors and by those with whom we have had troubles in the past, and when we fear troubles in the future, the only consolation is we will have to find that what kind of a budget they have, and looking at them and their budget and their expenditure, I would like to submit that the Indian defense expenditure is not large at all. Then what do we have as an operational doctrine? What are we going to say? For instance, do we adopt a thing saying that the attack is the best form of defense? Or are we going to say that our country believes totally in defense, and unless an aggression is committed against us, we don't move? Or do we say that if there is a war in one front, that it is a war all over? There is the operational doctrine is going to be extraordinarily important. You remember that it was Lal Bahadur Shastri who said, when the Kutch and then the problem in Kashmir, when Kashmir stopped, Pakistan started attacking us in Kashmir at the time of this one chicken neck in 1965, that he said, we are free to open any other front we desire. It is surprising that Lal Bahadur Shastri found it necessary to state that objective, because we always assume a war is fought in a front chosen by the enemy. And how do we then formalize our operational doctrine? For instance, that every war, if we had noticed the wars we had with the Pakistan, every one was started by the Pakistani aircrafts moving, violating our border before we started moving, crossing our border. So then, what is an operational doctrine? You remember the former Pakistani chief, after talking about the supporting the Iraq's attack on the American forces, said that we talk about strategic defiance. He never he refused to elaborate what he meant by strategic defiance. I'm not sure whether he understood that at all. In case we give him the benefit of doubt that he spoke in a great deal of after a great deal of thought, then he might have felt that our ability to destroy an enemy can also be dependent on our equipment capabilities. And today there is no use saying, I mean, the 1962 is a case in point, drive out the Chinese. Pandit Nehru did say that. Could he have said that if our troops, if our generals had gone to the Prime Minister and said, Mr. Prime Minister, we do not have this, we do not have this, we do not have that? Would he have taken the chance? But if you read the history of 1962, you would realize we lost the war even before we started the war, because of the fact that our generals went on saying, how can we fight the Chinese if their Soviets are helping them? How can we fight the Chinese if our Soviets are helping them? Without realizing that was a period that the Chinese and the Soviets were falling apart. We lost the war even before the war started in 1962, because we were not sure of our equipment capabilities. The enormous importance the equipment matter. It is, you know, it's all very well to say army marches on its stomach and so on, but today army marches on its tanks. And it is important for us that our equipment capabilities are continuously maintained. But it is here we run into a difficulty. Can we talk about equipment in every area being supreme? Or can we talk about saying that, look, some equipment is going to be better than the enemy and we are going to use that? Or can we also think of maintaining surprise equipment, like the Americans talked about the stealth aircraft? Can we talk about the equipment and the tactics going together so that the operational doctrine gets strengthened? And there are weaknesses and gaps. Every time we react and we do not act. When Pakistan had the F-16, we went on shouting, saying, oh, they got an advanced aircraft, we got Mirage 2000. And there was the only time then I think we moved a step forward is the fact we rented a submarine for some time, nuclear submarine from China. And that was the only time we said that we took a lead, only to find that the lead was only temporary. There are gaps in equipment. There are gaps in technology. If a general is going to give you a presentation today, preferably an air marshal, he will give you the border across. He will show you all the circles of Pakistani radar. Radars that might have operated 20 years back, radars that they have ordered which have not arrived, radars that are in the repair shop, the radars that are working. He will tell you all this and say, and will show with only two anemic circles put in our side of the country and say, sir, where are we with respect to the radar coverage? But the same air marshal, you tell him, okay, we are going to order radar, we are going to have every bit of our country in the radar coverage, and give him the money, he will say, shall I buy some more aircrafts? So the tragedy is the gaps and the apparent gaps and the weaknesses is too important a matter to be left to the military. It is this that the United States took a tremendous lead. You remember just about few years back that the naval budget in the United States was cut. So immediately the naval secretary, I think it was Lehman at that time, Lehman said, oh, no problem, we'll cancel two of the strategic nuclear submarines, we'll cancel that. The Pentagon said, like hell you will cancel that. You will not cancel that. You will cancel the other useless frigates you are ordering. the ability to choose what weapon systems will have. After all, you see the one in the British one, where when the whole world is de-escalating, Britain is removing her Polaris submarines and they are Britain is replacing it with Trident nuclear submarine. And she is going to have double the nuclear throw power than what she has today. And it was not asked because of the Navy, because the politicians said, in spite of the fact our island is small, there is a possibility we can be a major player in the coming years, so let's have the more capability. So the current weakness or gaps, even though our generals and air marshals and admirals will speak with feeling on the gaps have to be understood by the civilian leaders, mainly at the political leaders, and bring in this kind of a filling up of the gap on this area. And the same thing about the manpower status. The usually the complaints we have of our country is that we have too many people in uniform. But then we must also be aware that we are using too many people in uniform. We want them for protection of a civilian population in Punjab. We want them in Kashmir. We want them to have the flag marches in Bangalore to save the Tamils. And if you really start looking into this, we are using military ad nauseam. And then we say that you cut the manpower, they resent. If the military is defined as the manpower that ought to protect the country from external aggression, we should not be having the military used in the other purposes. So I think there is a need for us to look into the military manpower status. And if you go on telling the army or the navy or the air force saying, cut your population, he is going to say, I cannot afford it. But what are you giving in return if you say that, okay, you are cutting the population, but we are going to give you these new weapon systems, new missiles, new better early warning systems, and so surveillance system and so on, he will say, yes, I will cut. Until then, I am afraid you are going to have as many batmans in Delhi as we have some companies. Our money, our budget is going to be such that we are going to have at least about 4% of GNP. And we are going to have, this coming decade is going to be a decade of better surveillance, early warning, deterrence, dissuasion. So we have to provide this, and on that has the tactical plan stage. I do not know how many of you know that essentially our defense operates on a command given by the civilian leadership. The political leadership at one stage or other say that, okay, this we want you to do. For instance, let us say, we want you to protect the border of our country. And you should be capable of fighting for our country, of protecting the border, let us say, for 60 days of intense war. Or 100 days of intense war. Or 100 days of low-key war. Or you have to say, they can go around also saying, that we are expecting you to work in a subversive fashion so that the Tibet, the Chinese occupation of Tibet is removed. Or they can even turn around and say, you plan such that 4 Agnis can be launched against Beijing in a matter of 10 minutes. Now, one can talk about a particular thing. The one will be an empty statement, the other will be a real statement. The standard problem will be the usual conflict comes in, saying the political leadership saying, don't they know what they want, what we want? And the military leadership telling us, saying that, why don't you tell us what you exactly want? So the conflict, this is not true of country, our country alone, this is true of United States as much as it is true of Britain, saying that the political leadership would like to escape responsibility. The military leadership would like to escape their responsibility. So they say, you have not stated the problem clearly, because the very clarity of the statement of the political leaders might damn them. And the military will not be able to say, saying that the usual statement will be, why don't you tell us what is your capability? The answer would be saying that, why don't you tell us how much money you would give us? So out of this kind of a conflict, but this is a kind of conflict I would call a creative conflict, because that some kind of a horse trading takes place, because all the generals will frighten the political leadership, saying that if Pakistan comes, they have about 24 hours before they could reach Delhi. And the political leadership saying, no problem at all, I had dinner with the Nawaz Sharif, I have no problem at all. So it just goes on, and ultimately you evolve a tactical political scene with which we can handle. And to our credit, we must say that we did well in 65, we did well in 71, because some kind of a tactical scene is now accepted. And we would, every time an army would like to push the tactical advantage better, and every time the politicians, especially the finance minister, would like to remove this kind of a thing. One of the things I mentioned is our technological skills. It is going to be important because of the fact that there are areas in which we will not be able to get from other countries. The other countries, for instance, will not be selling us any missiles at all. Oh, if they sell us the missile, it will be the anti-tank missiles with a range of 2 to 4 kilometers. When we talk about even a missile like Prithvi or Trishu or Akash or Agni, we are not going to get an option in technologies at all. And the electronic warfare is a system in which we deny the use of electromagnetic spectrum to the enemy, ensuring our electromagnetic spectrum is always open to us. Roughly, that what it means is, if an enemy starts talking on the telephone, we jam his communication. If an enemy starts using the radar, we jam the radar. And at the same time, if the enemy starts jamming our radar, we know how to beat him. So this is such a powerful cat and mouse game that it would be ridiculous for us to say that, can I trust somebody else to make my electronic warfare systems? And because our enemy should be known, the enemy's frequency should be known only to us. For instance, most of the, let us say, the F-16, it would be rather ridiculous on my part if I go to an American company and say, I say, Pakistanis have F-16, would you like to help me to develop a jamming system of the radar which you have developed? So, in fact, we were reaching that kind of a technological purchasing power at that time. Now, we have gone away from this and say that, can we make some technological leapfrogging, especially in areas which are vulnerable, which are critical, on which our future war successes may depend. And also in materials. It is said that the materials are not the final product a soldier sees. But the successes in materials will determine whether we are able to build a military system. For instance, one of the rocket motors, for instance, the PSLV rocket motor today is made of a steel called the maraging steel. That has the highest strength of the steels, iron nickel alloys you have. The strength can be about 350,000 pounds per square inch, compared to, let us say, about 60 or 40,000 pounds per square inch. I have to tell you, because I am a metallurgist, these numbers I like quoting. Because if I use the maraging steel, I manage to do the strength about 1/8 of the thickness what would have taken in ordinary mild steel. But when we started making the maraging steel, we found that nobody would supply us the maraging steel. And we made ourselves the world's largest producer of maraging steel at Hyderabad Midani. And that year the company was also going in a loss, but nothing to do with maraging steel though. And that year I felt better because a Pakistani spy was caught by the police, by the American customs, trying to smuggle few kilograms of maraging steel from an American company. I was a bit upset because that kind of scrap I could have sold him with relative ease at Hyderabad and cover up my losses of Midani. But just to show that unless you are free on materials, you are free in nothing. It might be uranium, it may be plutonium, it may be maraging steel, it may be carbon-carbon composite. You know how big a fuss the CIA director Gates made the other day, saying that we have stolen the composites from Germany. It was tremendously amusing because the Germans don't have a re-entry vehicle, and why should they have the carbon-carbon composite, I don't know. The only trouble was Kalam spent 2 weeks in Germany. If somebody spending 2 weeks could pinch the carbon-carbon technology, we are a very clever lot. But it goes to show the tremendous suspicion that people have on materials, and every time you saw that story about the heavy water coming via Romania to our country from Norway. Every gram and every bit of these materials are monitored, and when you don't want to buy from them, everybody would quote for you. But the moment you buy, then you are in difficulties. So whenever I get quotations on many of the sensitive materials, I tell them, I would like to sell, would you find a buyer please? And the same thing in computing. You remember the kind of agreements that we had to sign to get the XMP Cray, as though the supercomputer mattered in weather forecasting. Continuously, we felt this. The argument given is, oh, you will use it for missile guidance. You will use it for the making of the atomic bomb. My friends in atomic energy tell me they did the calculation for atomic bomb on the back of an envelope. I don't know why they wanted a computing power for this. And the same thing on the signal processing today, that one of the important powers of our capability in making useful information out of an enormous amount of noise is in signal processing. Many of these technologies are on the embargo list to us. And there are technology areas. There are technology areas like semiconductor devices. You try to order an equipment with the semiconductor chip with a technology better than 1 micron. We talk about 0.8, 0.7. You would not get that. Newer material processing techniques like hot isostatic pressing prohibited for export. So, also millimeter wave guidance. At one time, you know, there is in the electromagnetic spectrum, you got the 94 gigahertz, 94 billion cycles, which has a window. That means it can penetrate the atmosphere without difficulty. Even on a rainy day or a cloudy day, this radar can operate. When we wanted to buy the diodes in a company from California, they said, we don't even export to New York. How do you expect it to buy from us? So we found that if we have to become self-reliant in some of these technologies, we ought to build up a tremendous amount of technological skills in critical areas. For instance, for a combat aircraft wing, there are 10 codes. But the moment you want a nose cone for a missile, there will be no codes. So we had to choose the technologies carefully if we have to meet some of the politicians' requirements of what our country ought to prepare for and our generals' wish list of what they ought to be doing. Can I have the next one, please? So what options we have got? One of the options is saying, instead of getting jitters every time when some movement of troops take place, can we have the capability of surveillance and early warning? You can never underestimate this importance of surveillance and early warning, because you might remember in that Egyptian-Israeli war, the last war they fought, Egyptians were almost winning till the American satellites detected one gap where the Egyptians were vulnerable and quietly passed it on to Israelis. Rest was history. So it is important that we are able to monitor the entire area of great interest to us, and we must be able to provide the early warning. The early warning today by ordinary radars is limited by the horizon. We can have very low flying aircrafts, we can detect it only for about range of 50 kilometers. High flying aircrafts we can detect for much, much longer ranges. But why should you fly high if you are going to be detected? So the only way to get out is to fly an aircraft with the radar so that the whole place gets illuminated. So called AWACS and E2C, Hawkeye. So we have to now look into saying that if we have to protect the border, and as we cannot have so many soldiers per kilometer as like Pakistan or China have, is there a possibility that we can have an early warning and surveillance? The same thing, there is a tremendous amount of passive defense concept. For instance, if you have the fiber optic wire thrown in underground and the light that's going in is affected by movements on the other side, you can make it as sensitive or as crude as you, as rough as you want. And these things affect the speckles of the fiber optic system. And you can not only know what is coming, whether it is one intruder or two intruders or just deer running away in the middle of the night. We are using it with reasonable success in the border security. And this kind of a systems can have a segmented approach. And these are called early fuses. If all these fuses blow, then we know there is a war. And the third one, there is a continuously people are talking about saying, what is going to happen to our nuclear deterrence? One, Pakistan has played the game, many say, rather well, because you remember at the time of brass tacks that my colleague Dr. A.Q. Khan in Pakistan talked to Mr. Kuldeep Nayyar saying that, yes, I have got a nuclear weapon, we have done it rather well, what does it matter? But these technologies are easy, you know, Pakistani scientists are brilliant. He wanted to frighten us at the time, but he did not anticipate the greed of Punjabi journalists. Mr. Kuldeep Nayyar went on finding, see, I had a real good deal with A.Q. Khan, who would buy that? So he went on trading his commodity in a London journalistic market and delayed the publication by a week. By then the Pakistan brass tacks was over and the news fell rather flat. The second time when there was a problem in Kashmir, Pakistan said, if we are pushed in a corner, we may have to use some of this kind of weapons of mass destruction. And Mr. Gates appeared in the gates of New Delhi, telling us, saying, come to an agreement. And you saw that for the past 1 week, I don't know what Dr. Ramana's reaction is, for the first time we found that the Pakistan Foreign Secretary saying, let me not be confused at all. We have all assembled everything that's required for the bomb. I don't know how many core is there. We are not moving forward. We are not moving backward. But we have it all. But then we ask the Pakistan Foreign Office. They say, we haven't got the full text of the interview from Washington Post. And when somebody gave the text of the interview, the Pakistani Foreign Office said, rather interesting, they said, yes, he might have exceeded his brief in one or two places, but otherwise he was straight. So the game of deterrence has been played, or ambivalence has been played, with a subtlety that does them proud. Whether it was during Brass Tacks, or whether it was during Gates mission, or whether it is this. And now today, United States is telling India and Pakistan, children, don't fight. This nuclear game is a dangerous game. It should be left only to us, people like us. So what do we do? We have to then look into our nuclear deterrent as an option or not an option. And our politicians, including Dr. Ramana, made statements which, if you read, mean nothing. So Dr. Ramana's statement, if you remember right, he said, oh, our scientists would not let the country down. He was the once first time a science man being a minister. So he thought he could, scientists would not let down. And yes, day before yesterday, my minister mentioned, saying, I hope Pakistan doesn't attack us with a nuclear weapon. If she did, Pakistani people will pay for that through generations. What did he mean by paying to that for generations? So everybody has spoken in such kind of puzzles that many common men ask, what did Mr. V.P. Singh say? What did Mr. Rajiv Gandhi? Rajiv Gandhi said, we will explore all options. What options? So there is a need for our country's political leaders to speak not in puzzles. I think we should give that luxury to our friends in Pakistan. We should be able to say that our territory is inviolable. In case you move, please remember all weapons at our disposals will be used. Or the other extreme, the exact state. The country, if you talk of rise to the occasion, right? It's a positive statement. The small nuclear bomb, we will decimate that totally as a nuclear holocaust in Pakistan. Does he mean that? Or does he mean saying that we will use all things at our disposals, including bows and arrows, that's all will be left after that, to destroy Pakistan? So this is something that I think somebody must talk now clearly on this. And also, when we go on saying we ought to reduce our population, in military population, we ought to reduce the large number of divisions we have. Do we mean say that we are going to strengthen our NCC, we are going to strengthen our territorial army, we are going to introduce some kind of a compulsory service? And how are we going to use the defense and development could go together? And these are the steps I think we have to do. And there are also, in many other countries, you would notice there are radars that are used in peacetime for air traffic control. In times of war, it becomes a war radar. And we have that surveillance that will be there in the ships as for Coast Guard to prevent smugglers. In times, they automatically become the naval officials. And more than anything else, are we using the one sector called the diplomacy? How are we not neglecting this constituency? Why is it that every time that we find that we have to go and plead through the military means or go to the Security Council, why not we talk at the diplomatic level? And how is it that our diplomacy has failed in many times? And there is a beautiful letter which you should read with Sardar Patel writing to Pandit Nehru. I wanted to bring that, I couldn't locate it. I think it was 48 or 49. He starts by saying, dear Jawaharlal, etc., etc. And then he said, I wanted to talk in the CCPA, but you were very impatient, so I could not express my views. And he said, our Indian ambassador in China spoke the way you wanted him to speak, and you were pleased, and he was pleased of having satisfied you. But please don't forget, Chinese think for a long time before they act, and the Chinese have interests in our territory. Our territory is not safe with respect to China, unless we take from now on strengthening the military one. It was not written in 1962. After all, Patel was dead long before. It was written, I think, 49 or something. One of the most moving letters, if you had only seen, if somebody had taken that letter seriously, we would understand that even then, there were some of our national leaders warning us of saying that don't go gaga and say Hindi chini bye bye. It was one of the most beautiful letters that we use it occasionally when we want to get the money for defense. Can I have the next one, please? Having mentioned the nuclear weapon, I should also state that the nuclear weapons are becoming out of date. Well, you remember when we talk about the weapons of mass destruction, when we talked about megatons, when we talked about the hydrogen bomb, the accuracies was really very, very low. Very, very low. You talk about ICBMs, you talk about 12,000, that's about 4 kilometers to 5 kilometers, thousands of feet, it's about 12,000 feet, something about 4 kilometers to 5 kilometers. And for that to a level, that when we were talking about 300 kilotons, you are talking about 500 feet. And when you go further down with that kind of a conventional warhead, are the case in the case of a Pershing missile, as well as in the Trident one that they were talking about, even Tomahawk that you saw in the case of cruise missiles, you are talking about an accuracy of 10 feet and 20 feet. Because the terminal home has come into play. Terminal homing, finally we could detect where we want to land. You saw some of them in the telegenic viewing in the Gulf War, where the cruise missile went, supposed to have gone through the chimney and bombed the place. And there is also the cartoon, I don't know whether you had seen, that there was a knock at the door in Iraq and somebody opened the door in Baghdad and there was a Tomahawk cruise missile asking, which is the road for Saddam Hussein's house, please? So, the accuracy, well, it might be a slightly exaggerated statement, but the accuracy of the missiles, mainly due to inertial navigation system, terminal homing, fring laser gyro, fiber optic gyro, has reached such a level that even we are talking in our laboratories and in some of our missile systems, when we are talking less than 100 meters as not a future possibility, as a realism today of missiles that goes hundreds of kilometers. You talk about tens of meters of missiles going hundreds of kilometers away. Why do we need a nuclear weapon? We don't want to kill innocent civilians, but on the other hand, we want to destroy the military might. And so we can say that sophistication of the accuracy, the inertial navigation system, command guidance system, and terminal homing, we would say that ICBMs and cruise missiles are cost effective even when they carry the Gulf, even the conventional weapon system. Having mentioned Tomahawk missiles and the Gulf War, I think we ought to have, while talking about defense, we ought to look at the nearest war that had been fought recently, and that is the Gulf War. Often, Gulf War has been quoted, especially by the Air Force, saying that why do you need an army when there is an Air Force? Which I think the army gets very annoyed. They say it's so different from in Punjab compared to Kuwait. They said it's all the same, give more money to the Air Force, we know how we can teach them a lesson. But the one thing we shouldn't forget about Gulf War is, we have used almost unlimited power. Tremendous, I mean, whether it is a research tool as it was Patriot, development tool as Patriot was then, some of the research ACCS, Command Communication System, every one of them was used for just one limited objective, drive out Iraqis from Kuwait. And we also saw that an enemy was totally isolated, except for Oman and Cuba. There was not even India was willing to side with Iraq. And everybody was with the allied nations. And the last one was, in spite of Saddam Hussein talking about chemical weapons, in spite of the thing he said, he will burn out and decimate Israel, it was an empty threat. He only had chemical weapons. And the chemical weapons with the missile with an accuracy so bad that he wasn't sure whether it would land in Tel Aviv or in Baghdad back again. It's always a fear, because when you send a missile, you want that not to come back and you want your aircraft to come back. If the reverse happens, you have very great difficulty, and Saddam Hussein had the problem with the unsophisticated weapons he had. Can I have the next one, please? So if you look into the various surveillance systems, you notice the satellites were used, AWACS were used, and the remotely piloted vehicles. They have used about 200 times the remote piloted vehicles for surveillance. And the electronic warfare, they had a field day. After the first day, none of the communication system in Iraq was working. In the last few hours of the Gulf War, the Iraqi battle orders were dispatched by a very efficient motorcyclist. No communication was operational at all. And the precision guidance which I talked about, and also the command communication system and intelligence, was working for the first time. It is very difficult to link army, navy and the air force because the frequencies of operations are different, the protocols of communications are different, and often it is difficult because some of them are analog, some of them digital, some of them spread spectrum. The mind-boggling technologies of communication come home to roost when you try to link three services. It was so bad in the Grenada warfare, of all the things, when the Marines wanted to inform Washington that they have really occupied Grenada, they had to take a credit card and do the international subscriber dialing to ring up somebody in Pentagon and say, it is real to say that they reached Grenada because the naval communication system, marine communication could not link up with the satellite communication. But this was the first war where CQDI worked, according to the reports we have, be extraordinarily satisfactory. There is also other thing, they have used the fuel air explosives, which is supposed to be the only weapon outside the TNT, outside nuclear, which has more power throw weight than the TNT. This is a fuel like dimethyl hydrazine. You pour it on the ground as it vaporizes, you ignite it. The shock wave and the impulse is so large. 1 ton of TNT is 1 ton of fuel air explosive is equal to about 5 or 6 tons of TNT. They use this to kill a large number of Iraqi soldiers. This is the most powerful soft target because the pressure is such that they saw the watch of one Iraqi soldier where every hinge was removed because the shock is such that no part of the bone would remain static. So I would stop here. Perhaps we could start that tomorrow. London, in the Ministry of War, as the Ministry of Defense in those days were called, a professor from Cambridge University, Lord Rutherford, was invited to attend the meeting and participate in the deliberations as to how science could help England win the war. Rutherford was late for the meeting and he was chided for it. Rutherford replied, "Gently, gentlemen, I was witnessing an event which is far more important than all these meetings that you have arranged. It's going to alter the history." He then added as an afterthought, "What does it matter? Science does not matter in the conduct of war." Today, if you look into Lord Rutherford's statement, we see that it is both right and wrong. Right because the event he was witnessing then was the artificial disintegration of nuclei, which was the opening of the scene for the chain reaction, nuclear reactor, atomic bomb, power reactors, etc., an important event in the history of our understanding of the reactions of nuclei. He was wrong because he underestimated the impact of science and technology on the conduct of war. In fact, there are a large number of examples in history. We occasionally see that in the television serial Mahabharata, where you used to see the arrows pointing in one direction, turning back in another direction, one arrow counterbalanced with another arrow. All these kinds of technologies were there before. At least they were supposed to have been there. But the real major one came in the First World War with the use of phosgene, the choking agent, mustard gas, the blistering agent, and also many other chemicals that were crippling soldiers, maiming many and killing. It was a period of chemical protection suits, dying in bunkers, dying in places where the chemical weapons were exploded. The result was the international agreement in Geneva in 1925, where the nations of the world agreed that the chemical weapons are the dirtiest form of weapons and they are really not effective in winning the war as maiming people. And the protocol was initiated where every country, any country that signed that agreed that they would not be the first to use the chemical weapons. Please mark that it was not one of banning chemical weapons, as the biological weapons got banned years later, but one of no first use, and you could use chemical weapons only as a retaliatory one. This was followed in the Second World War. Can I have the next? by the use of atomic bombs in Japan. So if we are looking into the military technologies, we thought of using the First World War as a marker. We found, because the antidote of the chemical weapons came very quickly through the Geneva Conference, we thought it would be useful if we start from 1940s and the period for the technologies for mass destruction. This is the first generation nuclear missiles and also the tactical missiles. I don't know how many of you would know that the tactical missiles were developed not out of the army asking for it, but for an initiative taken by Professor Oppenheimer, who felt that Air Force was getting more and more powerful, and it was necessary that a counterbalance is seen in the service itself. It was then he suggested to the army, saying that we could think of atomic bombs with a lower capacity, lower throw weight. He paid for that rather badly, because the Air Force got very angry with him, and you know the rest of the things that happened to Professor Oppenheimer during that period. The same period, rather quietly, Navy was developing nuclear submarine. It's important for us to understand and appreciate the importance of nuclear submarine in the conduct of war and also in the maintenance of peace. Today, normal submarines cannot be underwater for a very long time. Oh, they can be if they were not moving. If they were moving, their propulsion system is only battery-based. Only now we are talking of Stirling engines. And they could at best be about 8 hours. And even the speed underwater is much lower than the speed above water. Nuclear submarine removed all these limitations of a diesel power, inability of diesel power to operate underwater. And nuclear submarine, the only limit was set by the food running out underwater, and also people getting very, very tired. The nuclear submarines could be underwater for almost 6 months without great deal of difficulty. And this, more than anything else, this one vehicle is responsible for maintenance of the total strategic deterrence until today, or at least until yesterday, because there may not be a strategic deterrence today. And this came out because of the fact that nobody could detect the position of a submarine very, very accurately. You always get into difficulties trying to have sensors underwater, because you cannot transmit electromagnetic waves with any accuracy. The only way that we could transmit is through sound waves, and the mechanical waves have their limitations, and you cannot send sound waves very, very long distance. And this associated signal processing, through which you make sense out of the echoes, and also associated technologies that are involved, were so difficult that one could not predict the position of nuclear submarine with any accuracy like today we can predict aircraft with radar. I'm not talking about stealth aircraft, let's say normal fighter aircraft. Stealth are so few in number that they may not matter today. And more, because of this, every country went to a great length. The Soviets developed nuclear submarines which were as silent as they could be, because reducing all this cavitation noise, designing the propellers very carefully. And the Americans put the naval hydrophones all across underwater from Giuk, Greenland, Iceland, UK gap. The total area in the North Atlantic was mined with the naval hydrophones. So in case a nuclear submarine from Murmansk entered Northern Atlantic, the hydrophone sent alarm bells ringing in Washington, saying that one Soviet submarine was entering that period. But there was also an extraordinarily humorous accident. I don't know whether you remember, about 10 years back, one of those Soviet nuclear submarines got very badly entangled by that hydrophone cables that were put under sea, and so it had to surface. The Americans were extraordinarily happy, because that was the submarine they wanted to photograph without difficulty, and they could somehow make the submarine surface. The Soviets were very happy because they had samples of the naval hydrophones, which they wanted to get hold of for a long time. It came up with the submarine. The result was technology in both the countries improved. But the technology for mass destruction got improved with the technologies for precision attack in 1970s. The main reason being, the precision guidance started getting improved. I will have something to say about precision guidance later, because initial guidance, if you had looked into the inertial navigation system that came in the 1950s, were slight modifications of, let us say, the V2 rockets. There came then the stable platform inertial navigation system, and more than anything else, there was a great deal of satellite communication and satellite surveillance. There were also improvement in technologies of electronic countermeasures, countermeasures, so that we could see even if the missiles were terminally homing at a location, it could be dumb enough as not to hear the signals that were flashed across that, so that you could then talk of weapons known as the smart bombs. You heard of the smart bombs in the Vietnam War, where you saw the laser beam shining into a target, and these weapons could home onto the laser beam. Not a great deal of technology was needed for this. In 1980s, the improvement of technologies on surveillance and detection was revolutionary. There was no question of anymore of somebody cheating it on the surface or on space because of the satellite observation. Again, the only region where they could not detect easily was underwater. Even there, Americans did some exotic experiments, like trying to measure the slight increase in temperature or increase in color at some both in the South Atlantic and North Atlantic, because apparently these marine organisms like krills changed their color when they were subject to slight increase in temperature, which the discharge of nuclear submarine was providing. So the Americans started looking at the marine animals to see did a nuclear submarine pass that way at all. And more than that, the resolution of the satellite improved so much that one talked about even 3 meters at the 4 meters at this time accurately. The last one in that came both with respect to maneuvering intermediate range missiles and also maneuverability. This both multi-target also started becoming important. Multi-target started becoming important, as you will remember, in 1980s, we had that anti-ballistic missile treaty. For instance, Moscow was totally protected by kinds of missiles like SAM-5, which on detecting through the space radar could say a missile is aimed at Moscow, and it could send out a number of missiles to destroy that in space before the missile could destroy Moscow. The problem was, this difficulty was overcome by the Americans by having multiple targets. A large number of targets, like in a cluster bomb, these rockets throw out, some of them dummy, some of them useless, some of them the real ones that carry the payload. And the other one that came out was, even if we have to then one talked about the trajectory of these dummy ones as well as the real ones, and we could see by knowing the trajectory, they said we could calculate which indeed was the real one, which indeed was the dummy. The answer to that was the maneuverable vehicles, in which we said that the vehicle would hand over all these kind of weapons quite a distance away from the target. After that, these weapons would maneuver themselves to home onto the target. This game was really fantastic during the period of 80, where every bit of technology was used one after the other. In the maneuvering capability was so good that one talked about at least about 200 to 300 kilometers of comfortable maneuvering after entering the Earth environment. That is, imagining like Agni going up into space, coming into the Earthen atmosphere, and then let us say if I am aiming to splash somewhere in the northern Bay of Bengal, going near Kar Nikobar or this one. This technology came in a great deal. Grew up great deal in 1980s. In 1990s and beyond, we are now talking about technologies for deterrence. The credit for this, to an extent, much as one may not like to give it, should go to President Reagan and his colleagues, because who said that we would like to develop a system in which we can shield United States from possible nuclear weapon systems? We know it was an unrealistic proposition. We know many scientists wrote in papers saying it was impossible to protect the United States from every missile, some dummy, some real, some fast, some maneuvering. But then they talked about the laser weapon, they talked about the beam weapon, they talked about particle weapon, they talked about weapons on space, they talked about weapons on the ground. But the so-called Star War was the first time that showed it is impossible to stop this technology growth and technology mushrooming unless we came to some agreement. If something broke the back of Soviet technology, it was that inability to respond to the American challenge. You remember first time Gorbachev talked about saying, I would deal with you only when you stop the Star Wars. Reagan said no. Then he said, I'll wait for the election results to dictate what the Americans would do. Reagan came back to power. And every time when they came to an agreement, you notice, please stop the Star War, please stop the Star War. Of course, the ultimate irony is not too long back, Mr. Boris Yeltsin said, let us develop Star War technology together, possibly against Iraq, I think. And if you look, we talked about this kind of deterrence. The only deterrence, again, we have the limitation, is on the nuclear submarine, in spite of a very, very sensitive sonar systems that have been developed. And we now talk about not just anymore of strategic deterrence. Is there a possibility that we can talk of tactical deterrence? We cannot underestimate the possibility of a tactical deterrence, because early warning aircrafts like AWACS, satellites, and remotely piloted vehicles, pilotless target aircrafts, all these things can tell us as early as possible whether a particular aircraft is coming to our territory. And especially, one of the major problems of detecting a long distance through radar, mainly because of the curvature of the Earth, has been overcome by a radar floating on top of an aircraft. And there is also this, we will see some examples of satellite resolution a little later, showed that our resolution, if you are careful, can easily be as low as a meter. At least that's what many developed countries say. And one, if we talk about, let's say, the tanks moving in at a particular column, there are wonderful pressure transducers, mainly developed for kind of what Dr. Ramanna was interested at one time, saying, how do I detect the nuclear explosion in a far-off country? We detected the nuclear explosions by the seismic analysis of those transducers telling us how the pressure waves are getting transmitted. By locating these kind of meters at proper locations, we could identify where the nuclear explosions were carried out. There is, of course, there can be errors. It can be crude or it can be oversensitive. But there are systems now based on detection of pressures or detection through the light disturbance of the speckles in a fiber optic system with a laser beam. There are also laser beams which can all tell us, saying that is there a great deal of armament movement on the other side. There are also radars, there are also quiet radars, there are electronic support measures, there are electronic intelligence systems, and we believe that there is a great deal of technologies that are becoming available, both as deterrence as well as in dissuasion from an enemy taking an attack on a country. You saw a bit of that, though I'm afraid it was overplayed on the television, the use of the Patriot surface-to-air missile in destroying the Scud missiles aimed at Saudi Arabia as well as Israel. Later evidence seems to show that it was not the Patriot that was destroying the Scud, it was the Scud that was destroying itself, because the design was such that it could not take that high G load that was coming into the missile as it was entering the atmosphere back, because the original Scud, the range was about 200-250 kilometers, and here it was about 600 kilometers. The Scuds were breaking apart just at the time when Patriots was hitting. Decide who was the winner, whether the Americans with the Patriot or the Iraqis with their inability to design the missile. But it just showed there is a possibility that with a good radar warning, it is possible to destroy even a surface-to-surface missile. But to do that, so much of superstar technologies was involved. First was the geostationary satellites, I think 6 of them located, that was watching that the rocket plume that was coming in, the flash and the light and the smoke, and that it conveyed. And then little later, the radars started detecting the missile, and the trajectory was worked out. And then this was fed to the Patriot control phased array radar system, which could take that to destroy this missile. And it's a combination of so many technologies working together. And when one looks into what has happened in the late 80s and the 90s, we believe that these technologies, if the are capable of ushering in a period of tactical deterrence, as much as these technologies help to bring in a period of strategic deterrence. Now, how do we develop technologies? Is it the development of technology, in fact, is highly romanticized. It's really beautiful when it is successful. Alas, it is only once in 5 years or 10 years. The problem is it's a multidimensional one, especially the uncertainties. The first is, of course, the probability of technical success. You ought to see whether, suppose that you want to develop the phased array radar, will that give that same kind of a subclutter visibility? Will it have the low side lobe so that when the radar operates, you are dealing with only one beam and not many beams? There is a great deal of uncertainty associated with saying, can I make a success of this? And then, have you done that in the laboratory? Because in India, we do much more serially that laboratory work, then it goes into production, then it goes to the user. Unlike in more developed countries, all these things operate in a concurrent fashion. So we have to see what is the probability that it will go to production. And what is the probability of the production units taking it and making a success? And having done these two, what is the possibility that you will make a user accept it? It was Thoreau, the American philosopher, who once said that if you make a better mousetrap, even though you are living in a forest, all of them would come to you asking for the better mousetrap. I fear our scientists will say Thoreau is wrong. First is, if you want to convince your manager that you got an idea for a better mousetrap, he will ask you whether you have got a project on that going. Even if you say that you have got a concept, he will say, don't rock the boat, we have got the old mousetrap coming and we have got the credit for this. And later, when you go for the productionization, they will tell you, we have not got the tools for bending the wire like this, and also we don't have that kind of fuses. Why don't you improve the one existing one already? And why are you thinking of a better mousetrap? By the time you are ready for production, user acceptance, if you can go through the difficulty, you will suddenly find the government liberalizing a policy. Some super cats would be imported from America to counter the menace of these rats. So the problem of science and technology is one where everywhere you will end up with the kind of a conflict. Can I have the next one, please? Given these difficulties, it is not surprising that our research and development in defense followed a clearly defined three stages. Our research and development followed three stages. In the beginning after independence, we talked about saying, could we replace some of the spare parts? We had large number of systems, subsystems and components we inherited from the British. Some of them the results of being dumped after the Second World War. In the 40s and in the 50s, we said that, can we just have this small ammunition prepared? Can we have some of the propellants available? Can we have the communication sets repaired? Can we have the suitable valves required for the communication prepared? If I have the manual girder bridge, how do I operate the manual girder bridge without that kind of cranes that the American had? So if you look into this initial period, we were mainly concentrating on replacing some of these things. And this was also part of the heritage, because the laboratories grew out of the technical development establishment and other inspection agencies who were really concerned during the Second World War and after that, to see that how we can meet some of these requirements that will build the defense. But if you look into the history of DRDO, the history came out of two persons. One was Pandit Nehru, who felt that even in defense, we must have our science and technology. In one meeting, he talked about saying, look at America. America is strong, America rich, America powerful. She is powerful today because she was scientifically powerful in the Second World War. He mentioned clearly about the American strength in defense technology. And he said, we are a country, we should also become powerful in science and technology, not only in civil areas, but also in defense areas. Then he wrote to his friend, Professor Blackett, who was sometime an advisor to British defense, mainly on operational research and also in other areas. He was also a Nobel Prize winner in cosmic rays. And he came and visited India, spent some time, and wrote a report on why India must have defense research. This is a very small report, about 8-10 pages.